Hey everybody, and thanks for coming back to Serial Zombie Mom. I'm your host, Tori, and this episode is just going to jump right in. I know that there's a couple of people who may have heard about this case, and if you haven't, you're in for it. It's not a long case, but it's definitely a shocker. It's one that makes you go, what the fuck? So be ready and buckle up for this one, because it's definitely a little bit different, a little interesting. Now I'm going to go into this one a little bit differently as well. Typically, you know, I will talk about, the perpetrator and who it was and their early life and all of this stuff. This one I'm going to talk about the crime, and then I'm going to go into everything else. So, the Richardson family murders happened on April 23rd, 2006. Or it was most likely sometime that night before, on April 22nd. Now, about 1 p.m., April 23rd of 2006, a 6-year-old boy goes to the Richardson home at 304 Cameron Road Southeast to see if his friend, 8-year-old Jacob, could come and play. Now, when he arrives to the home, he looks through the windows and he's like, man, you know, nobody's coming to the door. He's knocking on the door. You know, nobody comes, and he's like, this is weird, like, you know, they're usually home, he's supposed to be here, you know, whatever. And as he goes around the side of the house, he sees, through a basement window, bodies. And he goes home, freaking out, and tells his mom, there's body at Jacob's house, with blood all over them. So immediately, they go and call the cops. Now, the Richardsons, Mark and Deborah, moved to Medicine Hat, Alberta, Canada in 2003 from Okotoks near Calgary with their two kids, Jasmine and Jacob. Now, neighbors say that they were very quiet, very loving, a pretty normal family. You know, and as I did a bunch of research and as I'm going through and getting accounts from, you know, friends and neighbors, and they're talking about just how wonderful and how that family was the family they all strive to be. Like, everyone, it was perfect. They were the quintessential perfect family. They had, you know, 2.5 kids, and, you know, because they had the two kids and a dog, and just everything was just perfect. They were loving, they were sweet, they were everything. Now, Mark, the father, was recently promoted to at his electrical engineering job from Encana Corp. Now, when the couple meets, when you find out about them meeting each other, Mark and Deborah both had kind of sordid pasts. They both were having issues with, you know, pretty heavy drugs when they met each other. But they found support in each other. They enjoyed each other's company. They knew that with each other, they could keep each other accountable. And normally they say, you know, when you meet somebody in recovery, you don't get involved. Like, that's not usually the best situation. You don't meet somebody in recovery because that's not going to end well. You know, you guys, one of you relapses, the other one's going to do it right after. However, with these two, they found a wonderful support system in each other and married shortly after rehab. You know, they go on to have two children, Jasmine, and then a few years later, 4 years later, they have Jacob. Now, what we find here is that, you know, the little boy finds them about 1 o'clock, about 1:34, so long enough for him to run home, tell his mom. His mom immediately calls the cops. So the police arrive at 1:34 p.m., and detectives kick down the front door. And they know that, okay, well, he said he saw bodies in the basement area, so that's where we're going to go first. They even hear, when they go in the door, a kind of faint whimpering sound. And then when they follow that, because initially they're thinking, okay, maybe somebody's still alive, maybe they're not as badly hurt as we thought, maybe, you know, whatever. Well, they go and they follow the sound, and they find the family dog curled up, lying next to Deborah's body. Now, she and her husband, Mark, are both found in the basement. Deborah's positioning when they start looking, they're like, you know, this doesn't look very natural. This looks like there was definitely a struggle. Something's not right here. And she was nude from the waist down. Her blue nightgown had actually been pulled all the way up past her hips, and blood was smeared all over her legs. Not really sure exactly what happened there. We can assume that it was staged, that there was some other kind of shit going on. And you'll see exactly why later on. Now, there had obviously been a struggle, and she fought. She had tons of defensive wounds, and unfortunately, she had been stabbed repeatedly. Now, somewhere, and some of the other podcasts have exact numbers of how many times she was stabbed. I did some minimal research here and didn't do quite as much as I normally do, so I don't have that number right now. I probably could go back and pull it from some other podcasts, but if you're interested, you can find it. But she was absolutely stabbed repeatedly. There were multiple stab wounds that obviously hit some vital organs. Now, Mark was found second, his arms frozen with his fist clenched in an upward position, which turned out to kind of be part of the body going into rigor mortis. So when they find a black-handled knife sitting next to his body, they determine, all right, this is it. This has got to be the murder weapon. It's covered in blood. You know, and the knife is just, I guess, where it's sat. They're like, okay, there's no doubting this is the only murder weapon. This has to be it. They also see a screwdriver sitting next to him, and it's covered in blood as well. But from what they can figure is the way it's covered, it's more of his blood than anyone else's. And they realize that he used this to defend himself and to try and defend his family. You know, here he is coming down, to save his family, to defend his family, because he knows he's got children upstairs, he's got a wife there, you know, and he's got to keep everybody safe. Tons of defensive wounds, and he fought even harder than his wife did. Like, he fought and probably was really close to, you know, winning. But one of the stab wounds that he had obviously, inflicted some pretty damaging things to vital organs. Now, they start looking through the house. They see, you know, there's pictures throughout the home, and they realize, okay, so the parents are both dead. What about the two kids? Where's the two kids? So they start seeing blood stains all over the house, and then they look and they're like, oh my God, you know, we've got to follow these blood stains. They're going up the stairs. So they go up the stairs and they're thinking initially, you know, okay, both of these kids are dead. And then they find 8-year-old Jacob still in his bedroom with his throat slit, lying on his right side, still in his underwear, because apparently that's just, you know, how he slept, was in his underwear. It must have been, you know, I believe this was, early spring. It was probably getting a little bit warmer, so therefore, you know, he was probably warm sleeping in the bed. Still in his grasp, or very close to his hand, was his little Star Wars lightsaber, covered in blood. He tried to use his lightsaber to defend himself. Then they realize they've looked throughout the house, and 12-year-old Jasmine isn't anywhere to be found. They can't find her, and immediately they're like, fuck, they took her. They took her. Whoever did this took her because she's a 12-year-old girl, attractive young lady, you know, very pretty, and they've had to take her. You know, they've killed the whole family, so it's not for ransom, so what the hell are they doing to this girl, or are we going to find her somewhere else? Or maybe she got free and is just too scared to come forward. So they start searching for her. Her photo is released to all media outlets. They even go to the school and start asking questions, and they realize really quickly when they're given a chance to access her locker that there's a little something off about Miss Jasmine. They even find, when they open the locker, a piece of paper falls out. Now, this piece of paper has a stick figure comic strip that has 12 pictures, so it's a 12-panel strip, that she drew. But this was anything but comedic. In this comic strip, she burns her family alive with gasoline. So then they're like, okay, something's off here. She's got depictions of her murdering her family. She's 12 years old. What the fuck? So what we find out is that Jasmine was treated really well by her family. Again, all the neighbors, everybody said that they were pretty fucking normal. Like, really great family. That she was a great little girl. That, you know, all her friends absolutely loved her. However, the mom started to practice Reiki for a few years. I may be saying that wrong. Reiki. Now, if you don't know what that is, it's a healing technique based on the principle that a therapist can channel energy into the patient by the means of touch. So kind of like massage therapy, and, you know, activating the natural healing processes in the body and emotional well-being and so on and so forth. Now, this can be a real thing. This can be a pretty great thing, as this is something that is actually used in a lot of different places and a lot of different communities. Now, they realize with this that Jasmine started having interest in things spiritual, things that were a little different, and even started delving into embracing Wicca. Now, I'm going to say straight out the gate, like, I am a firm believer in just, I don't know, maybe I should reword that. So a lot of people have a lot of misconceptions about what it is to be a Wiccan. A lot of people think it's, oh, it's witchcraft and it's this and it's that and it's, you know, whatever. When you get down to it and you really do the research and you really find out what it really is to be a Wiccan or be in the Wiccan community, it's not worshiping per se, but more so appreciating nature, okay? And I'm a firm believer in that. You know, we are given all these things in nature for a reason. You know, that yes, there are a lot of healing techniques, a lot of things found in nature, and why not? Now, unfortunately, when you've got a naive 12-year-old girl who looks at Wicca and thinks, you know, oh, well, I've seen The Craft and they're little witches and this one goes bad and, you know, whatever. There's a little group of girls at school that are all kind of goth, and she gets a really bad misconception as to what it means to be Wiccan and goth and all of this. She thinks it's all pretty much the same thing. This isn't the case. Now, the goth girls at school kind of took an interest in her, and she adopts a different look. You know, she wears all black, dark eyeliner, dog collar chokers, short skirts, chains, and even starts delving into the world of darkness through online forums. Now, her parents, Deborah and Mark, try to interfere, put down more ground rules, keep her safe, you know, whatever. Now, I'm going to say, I had a little moment, you know, back when I was a preteen, early teens, where I went a little goth for a short period of time, but I didn't understand what all that was, and I went right back to my normal me. I know a lot of people who did that. Now, you're curious about stuff, so you do it for a short period of time, but you don't delve into it like this. Now, this girl, in August of 2005, so she is 11 years old, she joins these couple of different communities. So, mindviz.com, she creates a MySpace, joins a couple of websites called Zorpia.com and VampireFreaks.com. And this is where she meets Jeremy Allen Stankey and thinks that she's met the love of her life. Okay? Jeremy is also goth. He refers to himself as Soul Eater. I think hers was Runaway Devil. So these are things that stayed with them through everything that happens here. Now, Jeremy, unfortunately, would be Jasmine's downfall. He is a 23-year-old high school dropout who obviously has quite a few issues and still lives at home in his mother's trailer. Now, the Richardsons find out about this relationship between her and this 23-year-old man, and they're like, "No, you're 12 years old. He's almost twice your age. He's an adult. You're a child. Not even a teenager. You are a fucking child. No, you're not going to have this relationship with this person." Now, being almost double in age, a couple years, hey, shit happens. I had a relationship when I was 14, 15 with an 18-year-old guy, whatever. Whatever. But the thing is, what do you do with that? It wasn't a weird relationship, it wasn't anything like that. But now, this obviously, he's 23 years old. He is 11 years older than her. She is 12 years old. He knows better. So her parents find out. They're like, "Absolutely not. This is not going to happen. You can't converse with him. You can't be, whatever." But they find that it's almost impossible to control her. There's these photos of her that are very, very dark. And I'm just going to put this out there. She's a beautiful girl. Absolutely beautiful girl. But she fucking does not look 12 years old. All right? This girl, when you look at her photos, looks like she's 18, 19, 20. I mean, she is definitely not a preteen in her photos. You get what I'm saying? So, Jeremy writes dark poetry, would talk to Jasmine on the phone, and even reveals at some point that he thinks he's a 300-year-old reincarnated vampire named Visago. What in the fucked up mental capacity is going on here? What the fuck? Okay. He carries around a vial of blood on his neck, like in a chain. He thinks he's some kind of vampiristic werewolf bullshit. And carries on this persona. Now, we find out a little bit more about Jeremy's early life, okay? He was very, very heavily abused and bullied while growing up. Picked on all the time. His mother was an alcoholic, and he was picked on for her issues with alcohol, as well as the fact that he lived in a trailer. And you know what? These are the cards he was dealt. It's not his fault. Like, whatever. There's nothing wrong with living in a fucking trailer. I mean, you do what you have to do. You live your life. If you want to get that better when you grow up, you fucking do better than that. It is what it is. Now, his father left when he was about 2 years old. His mother had multiple men in and out of the home, many of them being abusive as well. And eventually she remarries. Now, he even states how his stepfather was ridiculously abusive of him and his siblings, mentally, physically, any which way. Doesn't say anything about necessarily anything sexual. However, he does say that there was a lot of mental abuse, stating that he'd even tie the kids to the chairs and make them watch as he punishes the other children. Now, by the age of 15, Jeremy was an alcoholic. He was, mutilating himself with cutting. And didn't get into the goth community or any of that until probably about 2005. It had only been a year, year and a half that he was into this. So he was an adult already by the time this bullshit started. Okay? He knew what he was doing. He was manipulating these young girls who were attracted to him, you know, attracted to him like flies to shit. And he was like, well, you know, okay, I'm going to get all the damn attention. You know, I'm going to be honest. Not a very attractive guy. Not in my opinion. He had a, you know, turned up nose, just not an attractive guy. You can see where he could have been, you know. I mean, I won't say he's ugly, but not very attractive. I mean, there's definitely more attractive and there's definitely less attractive. But he could have done a lot. Okay, he could have been taken seriously and had a great life. Unfortunately, he took this route and started hanging around a lot with these stupid young girls. He changed his look, he started wearing eyeliner, he started doing all this stupid, you know, goth bullshit. And since he was older and he could drive and he could buy alcohol, he was always surrounded by these younger girls. You know, they thought, oh my god, it's so hot. No, there's nothing fucking hot about a guy that's walking around saying he's a 300-year-old reincarnated vampire werewolf named Visago. Okay, there's nothing attractive about that. Unfortunately, some of these stupid, young, naive girls think it's sexy and it's hot. Now, after being told multiple times that Jasmine was really tired of her family, they were refusing for them to be together, their relationship was quickly sexual. There were little parties and get-togethers with her little friends that he would show up and she'd wind up having sex with him, or they'd go to, you know, his trailer and she'd have sex with him, and here she is, 12 years old. So they finally have a couple of conversations, and there's screenshots in different places where you can see bits and pieces of their conversations together, where she says, you know, I just want my family dead. Like, I'm so done with them. I just want to be able to live with you and be with you, and I want them dead. So they put on this, or they start this plan, because they're going to end the ones that won't let them be together. And they make a plan for this attack. Now, to prep for the attack, Jeremy has to drink a fucking case of beer. He's obviously freaked out, okay? When I tell you everything that he ingests before he has to do this, you can tell he was obviously freaked out that he was going to have to do something. He drinks a case of beer, several shots of vodka, snorts a couple of lines of cocaine, several, in fact, drinks a few glasses of wine, and then takes at least one pill of ecstasy. He said after that, he was just, and I quote, off like a rocket. Now, Jeremy dons a black face mask, black fishnet arm stockings, a leather wristband, a neck bandana, and eyeliner to sneak into the home through the basement. He's immediately confronted by Deborah. She meets him in the basement somehow. Like, he comes through the basement window, or through another entrance in there. I think it was through the window, if I remember correctly. And when he sees her, he immediately just starts stabbing. Just starts stabbing. Now, she's trying to fight back. She's trying to keep everything from happening, and she just collapses. Now, it is unclear at this point if he removed her underwear or if she was sans underwear. So that is kind of unclear. I haven't found anything about that as to why she was that way. But if he stabbed and stabbed and stabbed her, it could be that he just kind of rubbed the blood down her legs for a second make it look like it was a sexual assault so that they're not going to be looking for, you know, that, or that they wouldn't think to go after him, or I don't know. I don't really know what the deal was with that, but her dress, her nightgown was up against, around her waist. So again, I don't know if it was staged. I don't know if she just happened to fall that way and tried to kick or what. But anyway, that happened. Mark must have heard the shuffle and the screams and the fight. So he's running down the stairs with a fucking screwdriver in his hand. And Jeremy actually states, and this is him quoting through the trial and court and everything, "Well, he came at me real fast. I was scared shitless and I thought I was going down. I went back up and I tripped and I fell. And he jumped on me and attempted to stab me in the chest. He grabbed my face and shoved his thumbs in my eyes." Now, he remembers telling Mark, however, as he's stabbing him, "It's what your daughter wanted." Can you imagine those being the last fucking words you hear when you're being murdered? Is that that's what your daughter wanted? The blade, we find out, that was used to kill them was bent at the tip, showing that that the knife had hit bone multiple times during the attack. Next, it was on to Jacob's room. From what I can tell and on different accounts of the story, Jasmine was upstairs through all of this, because here she was waiting on him to come to her and say, "Hey, all this is done, let's go." Now, I don't know initially if she really wanted Jacob dead, or if it was because he was there and he was witness to it. But she runs to his room. She's telling him, "Oh my God, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay." And she wraps her arms around him. And, you know, it seems as if she's trying to comfort him, that I don't know what's going on, but it's okay. And she tells him, "It's okay. Just go to sleep, you know, shh." And she's shushing him. And she starts squeezing and squeezing, and she's attempting to suffocate him. Now, unfortunately, he's fighting. She doesn't have him in the proper spots to be, you know, because she's 12 years old. She doesn't know how to kill somebody properly, you know, so she's just trying. And so he fights back. And it's at this point that, you know, he's got his little Star Wars lightsaber, and he's obviously trying to hit somebody with it. So, I'm not sure if she had a knife on her, or if it was when Jeremy came in and he handed her one, but at this point, she slits her brother's throat. However, there's different conflicting stories here, because when it comes to trial, they start blaming it on each other. "No, I didn't do it. Jeremy did it. Nope. He actually slit his throat, not me. I was trying to comfort my brother, and he slit his throat." Whereas Jeremy stands there and says, "No, you know, she slit his throat and smiled at me the whole time," or, you know, whatever. Now, regardless of this, this was a major bloodletting event, and she remembers and states in court the gurgling sound that her 8-year-old little brother made when she slit his throat. Maybe I should have put in a trigger warning before I said all this about the 8-year-old. But what kind of fucking person is heartless enough, even at 12 years old, to be like, "I still remember the gurgling sound he made"? Like, it didn't bother her. Now, from what we can tell, you know, the couple either they went and had sex and then showered off and then ran off with friends, or they ran off and then met up with friends and had sex there. But we do know that even the friends said, you know, yeah, they were all over each other. They were making out. They were having sex. They were doing all these different things when you know, they came over after they did this heinous crime. So when they're arrested, now they're running off all over town. You know, people don't know exactly whose car they're going to be in, how they're going to find them. And somehow they find them and they're hidden in the back of a freaking truck. Like, you know, for all we know, they were fucking in the back of the truck, you know, while it's driving down the road. Who knows? I mean, they were all over each other. They were so happy they were going to be together. Now, when they were arrested, they also arrest Casey Lancaster, which is a friend of the both of them. I didn't see exactly how old she was, but I know that she had a issue with drugs, and being in, you know, not the best circumstances herself. So when everything happens, now she's given about a year of house arrest and told, you know, she's got to stay away from drugs. She's got to stay clean. And that's really all we know about this girl, but she had to go for this as well. So I don't know if she was driving the car or the truck. I don't know if it was just something that she had been told about things ahead of time. I'm not sure. That I couldn't find a lot of information on. Now, I've watched multiple documentaries. I've listened to multiple podcasts, other podcasts about this. And then I did my own research as well. But some of that stuff is unclear. Now, sometimes when I say something's unclear, it's either I saw it in one place, and that's the only place that I saw it, and I can't corroborate it with any other information. So I'm not going to report on that as this is what happened. So I just wanted to kind of, you know, clear the air on that. It's not that I was lazy and didn't want to do the research. It was more so I couldn't find, in the couple days of work that I did, multiple different places where certain things were said. Okay, so I just want to clear that up. Now, they obviously did not show any remorse for anything that happened. Now, since Jasmine was only 13 at the time of the crime, when she's convicted, she did not have to deal with the same kind of consequences as if she were an adult. Now, the both of them were convicted on 3 counts of first-degree murder, with Jasmine being the youngest person in Canadian history ever convicted of multiple first-degree murder counts. However, since she was a minor, she was made only to serve 10 years for the murders. Now, in Canada, anyone under the age of 14 that has to serve for murder can only be sentenced to 10 years. That is the max that they are given. Because they figure, you know, okay, well, you're under this age. You must not have really understood the magnitude of what you did. So you've got 10 years. And during this 10 years, you're going to be psychologically evaluated, as well as being kept an eye on, but you're still going to be able to go to school. You're still going to be able to learn, you know, in a facility, but you're going to be able to learn and you're going to be able to have the possibility for rehabilitation into society later on. Fucked up, right? I can understand where they come from because, yes, there are some people who have done things. However, this girl killed both her parents and her little brother. It's not like it was one person and, you know, I don't know. It's kind of hard to explain. It's if like two kids got in a fight and she just grabbed, you know, something that was near her and killed somebody and was like, I had to get her off of me or whatever. You didn't realize, you know, the magnitude of what was happening or if you kill one person. However, this was three. Now, on July 9th of 2007, she was convicted. So, about a year later, on November 8th, 2007, she was sentenced to the max of 10 years. However, they went ahead and gave her the credit for the 18 months that she had already spent in custody from the date she was arrested up until the date of sentencing. After that, she had to follow this with 4 years in a psychiatric institution where they could evaluate her and make sure that she was sane, make sure that she was competent, to make sure that she had remorse, you know, or that she was not insane. So after this 4 years, she gets 4.5 years under, and I quote, conditional supervision in the community. So essentially it was kind of like house arrest, I guess. So that is, let's see, so 4 years, so 2007, then she does 4 years, so 2011. 4 years of conditional supervision starting, so September 2011. This is where she gets the supervision in the community. 2011, she begins attending classes at Mount Royal University and is released from the psychiatric hospital during that fall. Now, with it being reported in October of 2012 that her rehab was going really well. She was remorseful for her actions. Like, she knew she fucked up. She misses her family. You know, she's grown from that. She's no longer part of this goth community. You know, she doesn't want anything to do with Jeremy Stanky. Like, all this is over. Now, after the completion of this sentence, she was released at 23 years old on May 6th of 2016. She is now living under a different identity and not really sure where she's at. But we assume, there are a lot of assumptions, that she is near that same community. That it's not far off, that she's kind of kept pretty close because that's where she knew people. Now, what does that say? 23 years old, she goes back to the same community or pretty close by the same community. That means what? She's dealing with some of the same people? How can any of them fucking trust her? So, I don't know. I don't know what's going on there. Maybe she's gone to university. She's, you know, for all we know, she could be a fucking teacher. Who fucking knows? But here, that's been, you know, another 5 years since she's been out. So she's approximately 27 years old now. And probably living pretty high on the hog. You know, she's probably doing pretty well for herself. Now, do I hope she feels a lot of remorse? Absolutely. Do I feel she should have done more time? Absolutely. But she also has to live with this for the rest of her life, knowing that she is responsible for the death of both of her parents and her little brother. She is the one responsible. She is the one that killed them, and she has to live with this forever. Now, as far as Jeremy Allen Stanky, he admitted his guilt pretty quickly, as soon as they're arrested with a officer, tells them exactly what happened, like, he's scared fucking shitless. Like, he knows he fucked up. He shouldn't have been any part of this. He immediately gets done with all his bullcrap. You know, some people, there's a couple of sources that say he still kind of says that he's this Visago 300-year-old vampiric werewolf. However, he has changed his name and is still concurrently serving 3 life sentences. He was tried in November of 2008, and on December 15th of 2008, he was sentenced to 3 life sentences. He will be eligible for parole after serving 25 years. So, he's got about another, a little more than, somewhere around 10 years before he gets out, or before he's eligible for parole. Now, I think he might get out. Personally, you know, from what I've been able to find, he's behaved pretty well. He could get out for good behavior. he could, you know, be there for a little longer. I just don't see a lot of people really fighting it. He's been there for a while. However, what the fuck did they not charge him for statutory rape as well? They should have. Because here he was 23 fucking a damn 12-year-old. So he should have seen that as well. And if he does get out, he will have to register as a sex offender. Or at least that's what they should do to him. Because he was 25 or 23 years old fucking a 12-year-old. So yes, he needs to register as a sex offender. He should have served also for statutory rape. Whether it's concurrent or whatever, that needs to be another charge that he has on himself as well. Now again, he has changed his name since all this has happened. But I don't know if that was to keep from getting his ass kicked in prison. Because anytime that it's someone that's hurt a child or anything like that, things like that happen. But, you know, he gets out under a different name. He's going to go do that whatever the hell he wants. How do we know if he gets out, if they're not going to wind back up together? We don't. But there's always going to be that fear there. They did it once. Can they do it again? Or is she done with him? As far as we've been told, she's done. She doesn't want anything to do with him. But how can we say for sure? Now, that's it for this episode. You can watch a couple of different documentaries. There is an episode of Killer Kids. There is one of Deadly Women that actually shows the story of JR. Because when all this stuff happened with her being under 18, her being a minor, they couldn't release her name to the public. So they just called her JR. Now, as she's gotten older, and through the years, once she turned 18, like her name, you know, popped out there. People knew who she was. People were saying, you know, whatever. So now we know that she is Jasmine Richardson. However, she has changed her name. We don't know what she looks like now. We can assume. But we don't know what she looks like now. We don't know who she is. She's pretty much living under the radar from what we can tell. So if you want to watch some different documentaries or if you want to Google her or find out some different things, I will post some different pictures on the social media outlets so that you can see what I mean when I say she did not look 12 years old. And I'll post a picture of the family, you know, her victims, as well as Jeremy Stinky, because that was one of the names that he was called when he was younger. And, you know, just to make fun of him, he was called Stinky because Stanky, you know, his last name, I mean, it made sense. You expect kids are cruel. They're going to say things like that. So anyway, to get on with that. But I hope you guys were interested and realized just how fucked up the story was and how scary kids can be. It's not just adults. It's not just, but kids can be fucking scary too. I've got another case coming up in a couple of episodes where, you know, the person in question started having pretty scary thoughts even in the first grade. So when I get to him, you're going to be, you know, his is another shorter episode, but really, really interesting as well. And, you know, I don't think I'm going to get a chance to read his book before I get to record this, but you'll be really interested. Now, the next episode is going to be one that's really near and dear to me, one that's really even more so to my husband and his family. So I hope you guys are interested, and I will see you guys on the next one. Thanks so much. Oh, and don't forget, if you know, you have any questions, concerns, or anything, please email me at serialzombiemoms@gmail.com. You can send me some messages via Facebook or through the Instagram on some of these posts. If you have any questions, concerns, extra facts, anything that you want to add, I'll be more than happy to revise these episodes if it's necessary. So anyway, again, I'll see you on the next one.